that these elementals, for instance, the gnomes and the earth, had in some mysterious way control over the growth of minerals. And in the Key of Solomon and other magical and cabalistic writings, those who sought for lost treasures in the ground must first win the confidence and respect of the gnomes. For the gnomes can hide these treasures, just as the leprechaun in Irish folklore, if he is properly controlled by man, can lead him to the mysterious pot of gold at the end of the rainbow. But these nature spirits were recognized as being in some way necessary. There had to be some explanation for the continuous industry of things, the infinite organization of bees, and the wonderful empire which they created and which Maeterlinck has so wonderfully described. The story of Solomon and the ants. All these things seem to remind us that even the primitive impulse of empire lies in tiny living things that we can hardly see or study adequately. So the twofold concept moves together, each nation finding some peculiar way of dressing its symbolism to meet the need of the obvious facts. It was, however, generally assumed that there were controlling powers, that the consciousness tied up with the various levels of bodies had a certain intuitive knowledge of these bodies, but that its consciousness remained awake in itself rather than in its body. Now, let's see if we can find some parallels by which we can bring this particular point more clearly to our attention. Solve it a little bit for ourselves. We have no direct experience here of being able to disassociate ourselves completely from the body complex. We may be able to do it in sleep to some degree, and by reversing the process, perhaps we can get an idea of what the ancient really understood. Suppose we say, therefore, that the consciousness of, say, a mineral has a kind of sleepness about it. That this consciousness may have a full awareness in its own region, but that it has a dream relationship with this instrument which it is building. Perhaps we can say that in its subjective experience, the consciousness of the mineral dreams that it has a body, dreams that this body is growing or unfolding, dreams that it has some beautiful and natural necessity. In dream, perhaps the consciousness seems to be associated with that body. Perhaps it can dream itself into believing that it is a mineral. But because it does not have the instrument strongly enough to enter into it, it has only a dreamlike realization of what is happening to that instrument. It is aware, but not integrated with it, as in the case of man and his awareness of body. So that the ancients generally held that it is quite conceivable that the spiritual life of the plant, the spiritual life of the animal or the mineral, is just as inevitable as that of man. That the immortality of the animal is as certain as that of man. But the processes by means of which this growth is accomplished, these processes are more advanced in man than in the other kingdoms of nature. This perhaps is why the Buddhists referred to the animals as their little brothers. And St. Francis, with the same insight, had the same reaction to the birds and to all the creatures around him. He sensed a comradeship, a unity of life that transcended the differences of appearance, But when we think, as the Buddhist does, of these other kingdoms as our younger brethren, then perhaps we have some way of understanding them better, inasmuch as assuming ourselves to be adult, these kingdoms are life passing through infancy, childhood, and adolescence before they reach our level, with the mineral as infancy, the plant as childhood, the animal as adolescence. When we do a little study on this situation, we also can then say to ourselves, what else is locked within this earth evolutionary pattern? What more is there to the story than we can even see or sense with our faculties? Are there going to be other kingdoms launched at proper time out of the subjective of the planetary consciousness itself? In all probabilities, there are, for the simple reason that the consciousness is infinitely seed-producing. Everything is seed life in various stages of the unfoldment of itself. Now, if we go into Buddhism, for example, we can create our seven kingdoms in a rather interesting way by this problem of assuming the complete chain, Homer's golden chain, which binds all life together. We can say, in using the Buddhist concept, mineral, plant, animal, man, arhat, Bodhisattva, Buddha. In other words, we can have an ascending order of consciousness. That this ascending order of consciousness may or may not be all visible. The apex of the pattern in Buddhism would be to place man on the fourth level and to declare Buddha, the historical Buddha, to be the example, as they did, an example, for they never made it unique, an example of the transcendent possibility of human attainment. This would also then pass the pattern on to the next level of things. The Greeks declared that above man were the heroes, the demigods, and the gods. Do not sound too much unlike the Buddhist concept. In Northern Buddhism, where the Bodhisattva doctrine was introduced, we would have almost the same idea, because we would have the arhats playing the role of the heroes, and that is exactly what they were in Indian thinking in the old time. The arhat was the individual who is described as worthy of veneration. This would be the hero. The Greeks venerated their heroes. They venerated Ulysses, and they venerated Achilles and others whom they held to be heroes. And they declared that after death these heroes were lifted up into the sky to become constellations. The arhat, therefore, being the saint worthy of veneration, will represent the heroic attainment of self. And this more or less further fills in the pattern of his achievement. In the Northern system, the arhat was not as greatly emphasized as in the Southern system, but he did drift into China and Japan later through the Zen philosophy, which was more or less a philosophy of the hero of the world, because the hero self was represented more or less through the achievements of the great Zen teacher Bodhidharma. In any event, the arhat is the human being who lives no longer for himself, but in the quest of truth and for the service of mankind. He is therefore the dedicated one who has transcended, who has renounced the world. He is the Mahatma of the Hindic system. He was the Lohan of China, the Rakan of Japan. Wherever Buddhism exists, he will be found to symbolize the one who has not only transcended worldliness, but by this virtue has achieved strange, magical, mystical powers. He is the individual who, we might say, has the extrasensory perception range. He is the one who can see at a distance, who can travel through the air, who can ride on dragons, who can do all kinds of weird and wonderful things, some of them very important, some of them symbolically sounding a little silly, but it's all part of an elaborate symbolism. We can't forget the old Arhat, for instance, who made a fountain in his water bowl and went around with a little fountain playing from the top of his water bowl. This hardly changed the course of spiritual history, but at the same time, it is simply an indication of the power to transcend the limitations of material existence. All the Arhats, whether the 16, the 18, or the 500, or the legions that accompanied them, therefore are the heroes of the world. In the East, the hero is the saint. And in the West, the hero takes the Sigurd form. He takes the figure of the champion, the dragon slayer. In the Indian Arhat, the dragon had a toothache. So the Arhat carefully took out the tooth, patted the dragon on its head, and sent it on it back on its way into space to fulfill its proper function. In the West, with that true spirit of our own, the moment Sigurd saw a dragon, he ran a sword through him. This is the difference of our idea of what constitutes heroism. The West must conquer, whereas the Oriental is perfectly willing to remove the pain of the dragon and send him on his way. The Arhat gives rise, naturally in our thinking, to the next step in the northern system, which is the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva is called in the Lotus of the Good Law, the young man of good family. The Bodhisattva is the prince in the heavenly kingdom. He is a little like the archangel, Michael especially, but he is also more in the concept of the Grecian secondary circle of divinities. The Greeks had deities. In fact, most of their deities have a strangely Buddhist flavor about them, inasmuch as most of the Grecian deities were originally mortals, which is really quite a play in the direction of the Buddhist thinking. But the Bodhisattvas represent that Olympian court where on the top of the wonderful mountain Olympus, they gather in magnificent majesty in the Buddhist equivalent in the western paradise of Amitabha. Here is the region above the world where the heroes go when they die, where the good are rewarded, and where great Zeus himself wields his thunderbolts over a world not too good, but not hopelessly bad. The Bodhisattvas, therefore, are the beings, the demigods and neo-gods that have forms, that seem to have radiant natures and beings. In the East, particularly Japan and China, they are rather more chaste than the Grecian immortals, because they are devoted entirely to the great obligation that they cannot find rest for themselves until all living things have attained the enlightenment. But this is not quite as different from other systems as you may think, because actually it is the burden also of the Odinic rites of the Gothic countries. Odin, or the Teutonic Votan, the old deity with the long beard and one eye and the gray cloak and the great spear with the runes of the law upon its shaft. He went down to the depths of Mimir's well to ask the secret of his own soul. Odin knew that a strange destiny was leading him and all the other gods toward that inevitable battlefield of Ragnarok, where good and evil perish together. Odin was not a god in the true sense of the word. He was the patriarch. He was the one who managed the world, but was himself subject to a power beyond the world, a power which he could not fathom, a power which he perished from because he never was able to grasp its mystery. So the bodhisattvas are not too different. They remind us, Kannan particularly, of, in her various aspects, reminds us of Brunhild, the mind maiden of Odin. All these legends twine together, but out of them comes the concept of another order of beings above the arhats, the luminous beings in their sambhoga bodies. These beings that are never really here, but like the archangels, may even be listed among the saints. They are not regarded as imaginary, although we have never been able to find historical foundation for them. Well, there could be an order of life beyond anything we know. Those beings that Socrates said lived along the shores of the air. And finally, upon their mysterious eternal thrones, in endless meditation, are the Buddhas, the supreme mysterious powers of the All Fathers, the eternal meditations which bring forth all things. These may also have their parallels and their equivalents in this pattern of the earth, for in the Mahayana system, each of the planets, the Logos of the Greeks, becomes the Buddha of the northern system. Each of the planets is really an embodied Buddha in eternal meditation. From this meditation springs out the whole phenomena of existence, resting as thought in the mind of the meditating sage. His dreams bring forth all the orders of life, and as he awakens from sleep, they retire into himself, and he alone remains. This system fits very much more closely than you realize into the Western and Grecian theory. There are certain minor adjustments to be made, but the whole picture of the kingdoms will not prove to be essentially different. And in the, of course, in the Buddhist way of life, there being nothing inanimate, there being nothing that does not belong to life itself, we can understand why they bury broken needles with a Buddhist mass, where even flowers have their inalienable rights to exist, where animals are regarded as merely the younger brothers of man, and where the invisible bodhisattvas are only elder brothers. In their system, life is bound together by a brotherhood in manifestation and an identity in cause. All things that come into the world in any kingdom of nature come into the realm of suffering. They enter upon the wheel of necessity. They must pass through the great cycle of the nirdanas, or the regions of embodiment. And each thing that does come into the world has some strange fatality to the body which it has fashioned. Even minerals and gems are formed by the agony of the earth. Everything in some mysterious way arises from struggle, from pain, and from combustion. Plants pass through the same great cycle. On the walls and in the structure of the great sequoia trees, as we study the tree rings, we see how many times great fires ravished this area long before we know of any human beings to dwell here. Fires from lightning, fires from natural combustion, fires in other places from volcanic outbursts. Everywhere, life struggling against the inevitable destinies, and even the great tree that may live 5,000, 6,000 years finally falls, just as the smallest insect whose life is but for an hour. So in this whole great struggle of necessity, we find all kingdoms bound together by the brotherhood of suffering. The noble mystery, the fourfold secret, that all life is suffering. Therefore, in the brotherhood of suffering, life is fitted together into an amazing and wonderful pattern. And in Buddhism, over this world of suffering and all that it contains is the strange, quiet, radiant presence of the Buddha, Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara Kannan. Infinite compassion behind, controlling, directing. An infinite wisdom behind these things that seem so strange and difficult to understand. And something of infinite purpose being accomplished by all this complexity and all this misery and all this uncertainty which makes up life as we know it. So we think about the kingdoms of nature and all their various habitats and all their various ways of doing things. And we study them more and more, and we try to discover certain things that are important about them. One thing we have observed, and we do know, is that for some reason, man, of all the kingdoms, is the disobeyer. Man is the power which is most likely to exert tyranny over all other things. If man did not have mind, or any other kingdom did have it, man would probably not have survived. It is because of the peculiar tyranny of objective enlightenment that he has achieved his survival at the expense of nature. But in the process of survival, he has offended nature. He has offended the very life that bore him. This offense is not mortal, for man cannot perish. But this offense has complicated his existence and confronts him now with the objective manifestation of his subjective error. So man, becoming in turn a master of all he surveyed and setting up his own empire, has set it up in the inadequacy and the fallacy with which he has done everything else in his great journey of growth. So as we look back down through the kingdoms of nature, we observe that the whole form of life begins with a strange but infinite faith. That life begins as a total acceptance, and gradually, step by step, it evolves into a rebellion. Life begins by some kind of a universal consciousness, a consciousness adequate to all needs, and it slowly retracts, or in one way or another, crystallizes into a highly personal consciousness that is not adequate for its own needs. That therefore, this whole great pageantry of man, who may have been on this earth, they feel now, for at least 10 or 15 millions of years, from fossilized remains recently discovered, that in this whole problem, man has been becoming more and more like man. But in order to do it, he has become less and less like God. There has been a strange restriction in him, a strange battling in his own nature, which is very difficult for us to completely understand. He has moved from a very wonderful insight. He has moved from natural habits that were astonishing. Dr. Margaret Mead points out the lingerings of these basic integrities among the primitive anthropological types with which she has concerned herself, particularly in the areas of the South Seas. We have observed that also out of the past come strange reports as out of a sleep or out of a dream of things. And we may be able to make a kind of parallel again to this in man. Some people, rather nostalgically, have said to themselves, is man ever better than the day he is born? Or does he begin to lose ground immediately? And there's some evidence that he does lose ground. Little by little, something about man that is so distinctly and dynamically attractive that all people love babies. They just can hardly help it. It's really a very, very savory person who doesn't have some instinctive reaction to the infant. Some say that it is because the child is so beautiful. This is, however, probably a parental specialization. Actually, I think it is something of the helplessness of the child that brings out all the helpfulness in man. Perhaps it is also the fact that as the child first begins to live, if it has any opportunity at all to be itself, if it is not psychologically mutilated even in infancy, if the child has a fair chance, I think most mothers will agree that there's something very beautiful in the growth of a child. That it is something that is almost sacred. That watching the character of the child slowly form is one of the most magnificent, inspiring circumstances of life. It is only after this child begins to be over-influenced by conditions around it and perhaps falls prey to worldliness that it begins to lose some of this wonderful, sensitive naturalness. Children do not live just in this world. They live in a wonderful world of imagination, and they also live in a world of wonder. To them, this material world is full of dramatic possibilities. It is full of beauty. It is full of something that lures the child to run out into the forest or run out into the garden and just simply exist as a wonderful living thing. Perhaps this is also the story of the beginnings of life, that the lower forms of nature, as we call them, are simply these marvelously attractive things that are wonderful because they are themselves, wonderful because they fulfill, wonderful because there is no pretense and no conspiracy in them. There's something that's very, very much like a child in a beautiful flower. It has in it this magnificent power to fulfill its destiny. And in the mere process of fulfilling its destiny, becomes so beautiful that we regard it as one of the highest ornamentations in all the world. And we have used flowers for happiness, for feasts, for festivals. We have brought them to the sacraments of baptism, and we have carried them also into the last rites of the dead. Always, the flower is a thing of beauty. And it is beautiful not only because it is itself, because the wonderful law operating through it. But perhaps like the child, it is beautiful because it is uncontaminated by the knowledge or existence of itself. Solomon declared that the king of Israel in all his glory was not arrayed like a lily of the field. That there is something beyond all the ostentation of man in the simple growth of a blade of grass. The Zen monk realizes this. Those wonderful gardens in the temples of the Zenshu and the Tendai and the Hongonji in Japan, these beautiful gardens are really little nurseries of living things. Here, blades of grass play with little fishes in a pool. There's something of the wonderful paradise of that which is not corrupted. And naturally speaking, this is true throughout the animal kingdom. There are some exceptions. But although even these exceptions exist, we still find the young, even of the animal, to be almost irresistible. As it gets older, it gets too strong and powerful for us. But as a tiny thing, it is still part of this eternal helplessness of life. So out of all of this and a long pattern of things, we seem to see the world sort of growing sad and tired as mind grows up in man. We see something that is very beautiful lost. And as we watch the development of nuclear fission, we wonder if this universe might have been happier if evolution had ended with a daisy. I'm not so certain that such would not have been the case. But obviously that was not the purpose. we had to go on. We had to go on to outgrow innocence and come to virtue, but there is a very long, difficult path along the way. Sometime we must go on beyond this, and little by little regain as great objective power, this tremendous subjective power of simplicity, of lack of ostentation, lack of artificiality. The mind that slowly woke up in this world must in a sense go to sleep again in truth. But as it does so, according to both Eastern and Western thinkers, the childish gradually evolves into the childlike. That which accepted because it did not know finally becomes that which makes the supreme acceptance because it does know. So evolution was well represented, perhaps, by the Egyptians as a serpent with a tail in its mouth. It is a thing that ends where its beginning was. And yet in this great cycle of growth, something has been added. And this something seems to be the voluntary decision to accept truth. The plant, the animal, the mineral, even man at his present state, is really unable to make this tremendous voluntary dedication. Man has been given a power to choose, and it is this choice, apparently, that must lead him on to the next level of his own growth in space. The door that leads beyond humanity to one of the other orders of life seems to be guarded, and only those that make the great choice of integrity can go beyond man. These other kingdoms grew because of the power of protecting life guiding them. Choice is indwelling life, leading man from within its own depths to the next step of his own existence. And we can simply point out that these kingdoms of nature have always had very interesting symbolical meanings. We study all the esoteric systems of antiquity, and we can pause for just a moment to consider alchemy, which has a great power in this thing. All your planets, which represent the orbits or levels of psychic development, are involved in the alchemical speculation. The alchemical speculation deals with a recapitulation of the power of growth through the four kingdoms. In other words, it begins with the mineral. And in the retort, the mineral passes to the plant. The plant becomes an animal. The animal becomes a man. And man is transformed into a mysterious crystal being called the homunculus. And this crystal being, of course, is the adept or ahat self. But the alchemical process, as described, shows the entire evolution of energy, an evolution arising constantly within the mysterious retort or alembic of the Earth's atmosphere. All this procedure takes place within the auric field of the planet. And this auric field finally produces within itself the unfolding powers of, we might almost say, planetary deities. Apparently, the end of the evolutionary cycle is that seven vital centers within the planetary power, by this process of evolution, by this growing up and releasing themselves through the powers of the seven kingdoms, this wave of specialized life ultimately attains identity in consciousness with the planet which formed it or carried it or sustained it through its evolutionary process. When these waves of evolution become identical with planetary centers, then, according to the Eastern system, when the time comes and the planet itself goes into rest or sleep between days of manifestation, the planet having achieved this degree of growth as a total being, the seven powers, seven rays, seven suns of the planet, having unfolded themselves and returned to identity with it, the planet then becomes a sun. It becomes a luminous center. For this evolutionary process causes a great store of psychic energy to be added to the core of a planet. When this is accomplished, then the planet becomes a sun. When this happens, then these seven suns of the earth, representing the seven orders of life evolving here, become the planets of the next order of life and reveal their races, their orders, their species, and their types through the release of the seed lives within themselves. Thus, the evolutionary process goes on and on, each thing gradually becoming a self-center of spiritual radiance. Each of the mysterious powers returning again to the source of themselves. But when they return, reinforced by their cycle through the different layers and natures of the planetary power, they return rich with energy, rich with power, and returning into the sort of nirvanic suspension of the planet, they transform this core from a planet to a sun. They have sustained or supported this energy, which has become increased through its revelation through the orders of life. And when the energy reaches a certain degree of radiance through the structures it has built, it becomes a solar energy. The solar systems, in turn, have their same relationship to cosmic systems, and so on and on. Nor must we forget for a moment that we are a comparatively high stage in this on-and-onness of things. Below us and beneath us is a concatenation or a great chain of solar systems. Systems infinitely less than our own. But solar systems which, as far as the elements of themselves are concerned, we have no way of knowing what their consciousness may be. It may be that thousands of these solar systems could balance on the head of an ordinary pin. But we are not in any way sure that they are essentially different, or that they are any more lacking in internal consciousness than we are. We do not know what this consciousness is. We do not know how to estimate anything that is less than ourselves. We can simply turn right into our own bodies to demonstrate this. There are countless solar systems under the flesh of man. There are magnificent structures almost identically resembling solar systems in the marrow of bone. There are infinite orders of life living out their destinies in us. We have our minerals, our plants, our animals, and our humanity crowning this entire pattern. And to these lesser kingdoms, we are as man to these lesser kingdoms around us, and perhaps in the larger pattern of things, we are as gods to other orders of life under our own skins. These forms of life have no recourse against our whims. They have no way of protecting themselves against our inconsistencies or our intemperances. But we are presiding over a magnificent, complex universe. Perhaps there are within man more tiny spots of cosmic light than we can see in the Milky Way. Now, what are the consciousness factors of all this? To us, we can't even realize that these things exist as living things. We may examine them in a small cross-section or a smear on a microscope slide, but we have no conception of this. We do not know the hope or the fear or the pain within ourselves of these little lives.
We do not know how many minute organisms that we cannot even imagine might be raising their hands clasped in prayer asking us for mercy. We don't even know. From a standpoint of physical thinking, we probably don't even believe that these little cells have any life. But what do we know? For if they are alive, and they have to be, they are in some way tiny manifestations of total life. And if one of the most minute of these little particles was actually to cease, it is reasonable to suspect that the entire universe would perish. They can change, they can be modified by fission and other things, but if one unit of life died, then all things would die. Nothing dies, everything changes. Everything moves from one arrangement and one pattern to another, passing through different levels of consciousness. But what races, what orders, what incredible hierarchies may be in this minute world behind and below us in our evolution? From what almost inconceivable distances have we traveled? What part of our intuition, our psychic faculty, our internal sense has been mellowed and matured by this journey? If we have come an infinite distance to even reach what we are now, what infinite distance must we still travel? Where is the beginning and the end of this great program of growth? And how can we even contemplate it without the transcendent admiration for the inconceivable magnitude of the wisdom that sustains it? How can we doubt for a moment that this entire pattern is the manifestation of an infinite, inconceivable reality, and that this reality, perhaps, is the sovereign God we have been seeking? A God not an irritable old gentleman, but a God that is manifesting forever through an infinitude of worlds, through things so great and so small that they stagger us. They leave us absolutely incapable of thinking through this pattern of our own life. Yet we are here, and we came from somewhere, and into our very bodies are thrown these cells, these structures, these molecules that have also had an eternal existence dancing in some sunbeam of eternity. We are fashioned out of a gathering of infinite life itself. We are moving with that life. We are gradually striving to understand it. We are also looking for that time when, in perfect insight, we can give ourselves back again to the infinite wisdom of that life. It is all a very interesting and wonderful and dramatic story. And while we may not be able to remember all the parts, and probably there's no reason why we should, still perhaps it will give us just a little more of a fourth dimensional qualitative look at things, which can be important, can be useful in our daily living. Well, I guess that's all for tonight, folks.